Welcome to the Stem Cell Report. I'm Martin Pera, the editor-in-chief of Stem Cell Reports, the open-access journal of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. In this monthly podcast, we look at highlights from the latest advances in stem cell research appearing in the journal. We'll be speaking to authors to explore the questions that led to new breakthroughs and learn how they've tackled those questions. We'll hear about the background to novel findings, the challenges ahead, and we'll get to know a little bit about the personalities behind the work. Thanks for listening in. Human pluripotent stem cells have an unlimited capacity to self-renewing culture. So this property, along with their ability to become any cell type in the body, makes them a unique tool to study human biology and health and disease, and has provided us with a pathway to develop new cellular therapies for conditions like type 1 diabetes, Parkinson's disease, age-related macular degeneration, and many others. Unfortunately, though, human pluripotent stem cells also have a propensity to acquire genetic abnormalities in culture, abnormalities that may limit their scientific and clinical use. In many cases, though, the biological consequences of these genetic abnormalities remain poorly understood. Amongst the most prevalent genomic changes found in human pluripotent stem cell cultures are various forms of overrepresentation of sequences on the long arm of chromosome 20, with up to 20% of tested cultures showing some form of this aberration. One such anomaly, the isochromosome 20 variant, is also found in amniocentesis analyses. Our guest today explored the effects of this particular anomaly on the ability of human pluripotent stem cells to differentiate, both spontaneously and through directed differentiation. Therefore, findings were perhaps a little surprising, and they have implications for our understanding of early development and the potential therapeutic use of pluripotent stem cells. Today, I'm joined by three scientists who, along with their colleagues, authored the recent paper published in Stem Cell Reports entitled "The Isochromosome 20q Abnormality of Pluripotent Cells Interrupts Germ Layer Differentiation." Dr. Loriana Vitillo, the lead and corresponding author, is a research associate in the Institute of Ophthalmology and the Faculty of Brain Sciences at University College London. Her colleague, Dr. Ivana Barberic, is a professor of stem cell biology at the Center for Stem Cell Biology in the School of Biosciences at the University of Sheffield. She's the co-director of Insignio Biomechanics, Biomaterials, and Cell Engineering theme at the University of Sheffield, a member of the Scientific Advisory Board for Y-Cell, and a member of the Steering Committee of the ISSCR Standards Initiative. We also have with us today Dr. Pete Coffey. Pete's a professor of visual psychophysics in the Institute of Ophthalmology and the Faculty of Brain Sciences and the director of the London Project to Cure Blindness, all at University College London. Pete also has an appointment at the Garland Initiative for Vision at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Coffey has received many awards and honors, including the prestigious Estelle Doheny Living Tribute Award in 2009, Retinitis Pigmentosa International's Vision Award in 2009, the CIRM Leadership Award in 2010, and the New York Stem Cell Foundation Robertson Prize in 2011. Welcome to you all, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Martin.
Bye.
Pete, you've been a pioneer in the application of pluripotent stem cell therapeutics to eye disease. I'd be curious to know what first convinced you at the beginning that human pluripotent stem cells would provide a viable approach to treating diseases like age-related macular degeneration.
Thanks, Martin, and thanks for the opportunity to chat with you today. It's good to see you. It was back towards 2009-2010. We'd already been working on the possibility of a regenerative medicine approach, a new paradigm shift towards replacing the cells at the back of the eye, which are the cells which are affected by age-related macular degeneration. And they're those single layer of cells known as the retinal pigment epithelium, the RPE. So we've done a lot of work using embryonic stem cells, specifically with collaborations with Sheffield, and that's why we still have that collaboration with Ivana, because of that historical collaboration. But one thing which was a major issue at the time, and specifically and extensively within the US, with the use of embryonic stem cells. So was there the ability to actually really go forward with a therapeutic in which it had been developed from embryonic? And at the time, obviously 2004, Yamanaka was actually using the new technology of induced pluripotent stem cells. And at the time, I was collaborating with a group in California, which included Dennis Clegg and Jamie Thompson, and had the opportunity to actually take what was one of the first cells Jamie had worked on, Jamie Thompson had worked on in Madison, back to London, at which point the lab here just thought it was crazy. Skin cells turning into eye cells, Pete's definitely lost it now. And actually, it did. I mean, we compared what happened with the embryonic with what happened with Jamie's iPS line, and we got RPE. And the major issue there was the ethical issue then wasn't going to be an issue. But more importantly, the greater aspect and wish for me was just the possibility of it overcoming what may be an immunological issue with that type of patient-derived cell. Whereas using, the autologous approach, which was, a biopsy from the patient, turn it into an iPS. So, that was my reason for using it. And we have continued to use it. We have banks of GMP cells now, which have been derived from patients here in London at Moorfields Eye Hospital.
So it was really iPS cells that gave you impetus to really push forward hard. And that's terrific. We'll talk more about your cell therapy projects in a bit. So Yvonne, it's funny what you can find out about people on the internet. So I read on a Sheffield University website that your research career began with what sounds like a pretty successful high school science project. So tell us a little bit about the journey that eventually led to your recent appointment as professor of stem cell biology at Sheffield.
Thanks, Martin. Yes, this was all rather a long time ago, but it's true. I was very lucky to have experienced the joys of research in my formative years. And it all started back in high school when I did a mini project, which wasn't on stem cells, but at the time I was interested in whether shellfish that grow in the sea in different locations around my hometown exhibit different levels of pollution, depending on location in which they grow. So that was my question, and I devised some experiments to investigate this and carried out those experiments. And then I ended up writing my findings and participating in various national and international competitions in biology. And so for me, that was a really great insight, not just into research work, but actually into career in science, because I did kind of the whole journey from doing experimental work to writing up my findings to then presenting it and defending it in front of my peers. And I found it a really rewarding experience, in particular, coming up with different hypotheses and finding ways of addressing my burning questions. I think that was a kind of a defining moment that really spurred me on to take up a career in science. And it also made me appreciate how important it is to provide young budding scientists with opportunities to experience research. And that's why I take every opportunity to provide placements in my lab. And also I'm very active in outreach activities with schools, trying to enthuse and motivate further young people to take up this amazing career.
Thanks so much. Well, it sounds like a great project, but I'm glad you're in stem cell research rather than environmental toxicology. I think we're all better off for your choice. So, Loriana, this paper is interesting on a number of levels. One question, I mean, I know the answer to this, but our audience might be interested in it, is why did you choose to characterize a chromosomally abnormal cell line? So abnormal cells are usually thought of contaminants that confound the interpretation of results or restrict the use of cells for therapeutic purposes. But you selected these cells specifically to understand the role of this defect. So tell us more about how this study began and what your goals were.
It's very true that deciding to characterize specifically to great lengths a somehow undesired abnormality is not the most obvious of choices. But let me take a step back. this project started under the umbrella of the UK Regenerative Medicine Platform, which is a consortium of scientists, experts in the field of regenerative medicine and cell therapy, brought together to tackle some of the major key roadblocks that hamper translation of stem cells and other therapies to clinic. So we knew after long conversation that there are an evidence that there are abnormalities arising in culture, and this creates concerns. But we weren't just satisfied with just detecting the abnormalities and discarding them as and when they occurred. We knew they were present, and we also knew the mechanisms driving those abnormalities. But this still told us very little of what these abnormalities actually did in the context of a differentiation. So what we really were interested in, and our key question was, so what happens really when an abnormality is put in real life through a protocol, and what happened to the progeny, especially cell types that have a very clear application in clinics, such as the retina pigment epithelium. So we decided our objective is to take an abnormality that was really common, and we had isogenic lines in Sheffield, the isochromosome 20Q, but was also poorly characterized. And we decided to put it through a very robust protocol with clinical application. And in this case, Pete's retina pigment epithelium protocol, it's brilliant because it's directed and is also very straightforward. So it has clinical applications, but it's also quite straightforward because it's based on a spontaneous method. And we just wanted to see what happened to the variants. We really didn't really have an hypothesis. We were quite open to what we would have found. And that was actually an asset. We think being open-minded about the results was what led us then to be able to follow the unexpected findings that unfolded in this study.
Terrific. That's a very clear explanation and a very good rationale for what you did. Ivana, turning to a more general question, you're an expert on the genomic stability of pluripotent stem cells. Can you give us an appreciation of their stability or instability during standard laboratory use? You know, we know from a number of studies that the majority of pluripotent stem cell lines actually display considerable stability. And a question that always bothers me, you know, I was amazed to look and see that it's over 20 years since Peter Andrews' group first described this phenomenon of recurrent genetic abnormalities, then in embryonic stem cells. 20 years on, have we got any insight into how to prevent their appearance?
Indeed. Yeah, Martin, as you said, I think we've accrued so much data over the last 20 years in terms of karyotypic, but also other types of genetic changes that occur both in embryonic stem cells and in induced pluripotent stem cells. And really what this data is telling us is that pluripotent stem cells are not inherently unstable cells. And we can say this because we can grow HPSCs for long periods of time without them changing the karyotype. We and others have also done direct experiments to measure mutation rate in these cells. And that showed us that mutation rate in HPSCs is lower than what's been estimated in somatic cells, and certainly lower than what's estimated in cancer cells. And of course, this is great news. And I think we wouldn't be contemplating regenerative medicine applications with HPSCs if they were inherently unstable. However, just like any cells, HPSCs are subject to mutation. And if the acquired mutation happens to provide selective growth advantage to the variant cell, then they're likely to take over the culture, outcompete their wild-type counterparts. And this is what we are seeing. So I think we have made significant strides in understanding both this process of mutation and selection, but it has been somewhat of a moving goalpost. And this, I think, partly because, as we all know, culture conditions for HPSCs have changed so much in the last 20 years. So we went from feeder-based, KOSR-based conditions to now feeder-free. And it is something that we discussed within the International Stem Cell Initiative, that it would be really valuable and useful for us to have some sort of a database where we could collate all the genetic changes that have been reported with the culture conditions in which they have been reported to start making this clear correlation between culture conditions and the types of variants that we see. So I think ultimately to tackle this problem, we need that sort of knowledge coupled with detailed mechanistic understanding of the mechanisms of mutation and selection in order to devise strategies for minimizing variant appearance.
Yeah, and I'll just let our audience know that you've done some terrific work on the mechanisms whereby those variant cells can outcompete normal cells. Hopefully that'll give us some insight into how to reverse that advantage or eliminate it. But to follow up with this paper, Ivana, here you looked specifically at isochromosome 20Q. Interesting because it's also found at some frequency in amniocentesis, meaning it occurs in vivo. So do we know anything about the effects of this mutation on early development? And of course, other common recurrent variants are associated with germ cell tumors, which one can regard as essentially developmental disorders. So talk about the link between development and these abnormalities.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's overall fair to say that we know very little about the impact of isochromosome 20Q or in fact any other specific aneuploidy on early human development. That's just still a black box for us. Having said that, yes, there are multiple studies that reported the presence of the isochromosome 20Q in prenatal diagnosis. In some of those cases, there were also reports associated with severe fetal abnormalities, suggesting that the presence of mosaicism of isochromosome 20Q is likely to disrupt normal development. However, there were also cases where studies that showed that prenatal diagnosis of mosaicism of isochromosome 20Q eventually led to normal birth. So there is a bit of controversy that's difficult to reconcile, but presuming that the report that prenatal diagnosis was indeed reflective of the cells within the embryo, one possibility is that the outcome of development, so whether normal or disrupted, depends on the level of mosaicism of isochromosome 20Q in the embryo. Interestingly, isochromosome 20Q is not an aberration that's frequently detected in cancer. But as you say, the other aberrations, recurrent variants that we tend to see in HPSC cultures, like gain of chromosome 12 or 17 or 1, they do occur quite commonly in cancer and particularly in germ cell tumors. And I think there's a very interesting link there because the stem cells of germ cell tumors, teratocarcinomas, known as embryonal carcinoma cells, they are also pluripotent stem cells. So the fact that we find the same genetic changes in HPSCs in vitro as we find in embryonal carcinoma cells in vivo, I think it's telling us that there's some commonality to their occurrence and that pathways that are disrupted by these genetic changes are pertinent to pluripotent cells, whether they grow in vitro or in vivo.
Thank you. Pete, coming along to considerations for therapy, your paper characterizes spontaneous differentiation of these cells into retinal pigment epithelium, a cell type that, as you mentioned, is being used in several clinical trials around the world, including a couple you've helped to lead. Be curious to know what are some of the methods you use during the manufacturing of cells for patient therapy to ensure they're not acquiring potentially hazardous mutations. And also, I wonder, you might comment on the safety track record of pluripotent stem cell therapy in this field, which as far as I can tell is pretty good. And do you think we're overly concerned with this issue of potential tumorigenicity?
I'm going to answer the latter one and then come back to the manufacturing safety. So by far the major issue for the regulators when we were starting all this back in 2007 was this whole problem about tumorigenicity. And that came from, as you know, historical work, Martin, which was one pluripotent cell in your cell culture had the capacity to form tumors. Now, that work in its own right was quite old and hadn't really been repeated. but it was something that was there in the actual science literature, and it's something the regulators were really worried about. So in the development of the therapy, the preclinical work that had to be done, we had to ensure for ourselves, not just the regulators, for the safety of the patient, that it wasn't going to be the case that there was the potential for that therapeutic to turn tumorigenic. And that's exactly what we did. And we did it in a number of ways. We tainted cultures which had RPE in, and just with pure pluripotent cells to see how that would develop in the manufacturing process. We used skid mice to see whether putting pure embryonic cells in would form tumors versus if we put RPE in. And to our surprise, even if you put a pure culture of embryonic pluripotent cells into the eye of a rodent, the chances are less than 20% are going to get tumors, which in its own right was quite surprising. Equally, as soon as you start culturing those cells, even before you actually put them into an animal, and you take them through some differentiation protocol, those pluripotent cells don't last, they die. So it was quite clear to us that even in that process of the preclinical work, the possibility of tumors was minimal, very, very, very low. The number of pluripotent cells you had to put in just to even get a tumor was huge. So again, it really did question that, well, if you've got one pluripotent cell, you're going to end up with a tumor. And as Ivana was saying, those types of tumors as well, pterocarcinomas exactly, that's probably one of the easiest treated carcinoma you can get anyway. So that whole fear, and as you rightly say, the number of trials now that have been presented to the regulators, none of them are actually showing tumorigenicity. And then to come back to the manufacturing in terms of the protocols to look at aberrations is still, I would say, fairly crude. They're still using karyotyping as a method. And I won't go much further on that because I know you'll be asking Ivana to you know, mention the work that ISSCR and Ivana are doing in trying to help in that protocol, because there are some good advances there to actually give a much more clearer picture in that analysis of aberrations.
Thank you. Loriana, from your initial experiments of looking at spontaneous differentiation of these abnormal cells, you found a new role for isochromosome 20Q in kind of restricting the developmental competency of pluripotent cells. Can you tell us specifically what you found along those lines?
Yes. So from the very first experiment we conducted on isochrome 20Q, it's really clear that there was something unique about this mutation, to say the least. So having differentiated many pluripotent cells in my life, I was really taken aback by this first result, as the cells really shown very little sign of spontaneous differentiation compared to normal cells. They had also like a homogeneous, almost undifferentiated, but not undifferentiated morphology. They were what I would call in a limbo, and they then died after only a couple of weeks in the protocol, while the normal counterparts, which didn't have ISO20Q, but the same genetic background, were doing what we expected. So we knew there was something to do with the ISO20Q. And then we had the intuition that this was not just to do with the eye lineage, because that PEATS protocol is spontaneous, so it could have involved all the germ layers. And when we delved a bit more deep into this with genetic analysis, we found that actually the ISO20Q cells fail to downregulate self-renewal associated markers at a time point where you would expect, and actually the normal cells do. And at the same time, they didn't upregulate the three germ layers as such. So this is quite striking, and we deduce that the germ layers, which is the epiblast root of the embryo proper in the embryo in vivo, was somehow impaired by the presence of this abnormality. This could have meant that the cells were incapable of differentiating completely, but that was not the case as well. So when we did some small manipulation with some screening, we found that by the addition of just small factors such as BMP2 morphogen or a small molecule inhibiting TGF-beta to this standard protocol, spontaneous, was able, this modification, to overcome the shortcomings on ISO 20Q and allow them to survive and allow them to differentiate and specialize. What we found then, and that's again another surprising factor, that we found that the cells express high level of human chorionic gonadotropin, which is the pregnancy hormone. This was totally unexpected, and we realized we actually had conditioned for extraembryonic differentiation. This applied also for the normal cells, but we discovered that actually the ISO 20Q had a high level of bias. They were expressing more markers for extraembryonic than the normal cells too. So at this point, somehow from the bizarre behavior of this abnormality, and keep in mind, we didn't have an hypothesis, so we're kind of looking around, trying to understand what was happening. We started to have a more clear picture. And it seemed like the abnormal cells were really, in fact, showing a preference for extraembryonic lineages versus the classic germ layer root, which is what embryonic pluripotent cells do. And then looking at the literature, this really resonated well with a new pluridepletion mechanism and the developmental bottlenecks that are associated with this and the cells segregation.
Great. We'll come back to the interpretation of some of those really interesting results in a second. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll continue our discussion.
Stem Cell Reports is ISSCR's open access peer-reviewed society journal for scientists by scientists. The journal publishes research and commentaries that drive the field of stem cell science forward.
Welcome back to the Stem Cell Report. We've been talking with Loriana Vitillo, Ivana Barbaric, and Peter Coffey on culture-induced changes in pluripotent stem cells. Loriana, to return to a point we were just touching on, the cells with isochromosome 20Q appear to remain viable as they differentiated into the extraembryonic lineages. And there's this kind of theory that the extraembryonic lineages can serve as a sort of, I'll call it a refuse tip for aneuploid cells that arise during development. Can you tell us a bit more about this general concept?
Yeah, it is really fascinating phenomenon, and I think it's gathering more and more evidence in the field of trophoblast research. It is the fact that in the face of abnormalities, the human embryo, but also earlier, the zygote almost, has somehow mechanism to expel mutated or abnormal cells to the extraembryonic space to kind of protect the integrity, the genetic integrity of the embryo. So there is very interesting work from Gordon Smith and Benjamin's group at Cambridge University that has found that the human placenta, which is a transitory organ, has a high level of genetic mosaicism and high mutation rate compared to somatic tissue. This is really interesting because it sort of means that it acts as a recipient of abnormal cells of fetal origin. And they show also that there are various bottlenecks upon which the cells from the inner cell mass segregates to the extraembryonic space. And this means that there is developmental tolerance to aberration more than we have expected. It will imply that there is a genetic, to maintain the genetic integrity of their embryo, there are aneuploidy depletion mechanism in place that allow mutated cells to be somehow put away and protecting the embryo from this effect. And obviously this has huge implication for the way we assess embryo in safety studies prior IVF implantation, because the paradigm is that obviously you don't want to continue with anything that has an abnormality for IVF purposes. And this tells a lot about early development. This mechanism of aneuploidy depletion are still poorly understood. And there is a belief that in vitro model of embryogenesis, which are really interesting, and there are more and more coming up. I think there is actually a podcast on this from this stem cell reports. There are gastroloids and there are like embryo body and aggregates methods to basically simulate early development in vitro. And this really could be a good method to study the effect of these mutations into early development. And I think that ISO 20Q offer a tool for this type of studies. But anecdotally, although this is an area that I wasn't really very familiar with and I stumbled across, when I first realized the link of this work with the studies, I had the coincidence to meet the networking event, an IVF legend, Stuart Lavery of UCLH. And when I was explaining my very new then finding, he said, "Oh, but we always knew this from embryology, that there are mutated cells that disappear." So for me, it was a really great moment.
Terrific, thanks. And maybe your findings are, in a sense, what Pete was talking about, kind of good news for those who want to make specialized cells. The abnormal ones just have a hard time doing it, at least with this particular lesion. So following on from that, Ivana, is it known that extraembryonic lineages have a greater tolerance for aneuploidy? I'm thinking of tetraploid aggregation chimeras, for instance. But how might that work? You're an expert on cell competitions. Do you think those mechanisms might be different in these extraembryonic lineages?
It's a, as Loriana said, a fascinating question. So it does appear that extraembryonic lineages have a greater tolerance to aneuploidy. And interestingly, most aneuploidy that's due to mitotic errors is actually rather prevalent in early development. So according to some estimates, aneuploid cells are present in as many as half of pre-implantation embryos. But intriguingly, the levels of aneuploidy or the proportion of aneuploid cells decreases as development progresses. And that implies, as you say, some sort of mechanism to eliminate these cells from the embryo proper. One mechanism that's been suggested, and as you and Loriana discussed, is this segregation of aneuploid cells to trophectoderm. That would prevent these abnormal cells from contributing to the embryo proper. But why are they tolerated in trophectoderm? I find that a really fascinating question. And again, one hypothesis around this is that, you know, aneuploidy may provide these cells with higher proliferation rates and better invasiveness. We see similar features in aneuploid cancer cells. And so it is possible that, you know, the aneuploidy in these extraembryonic lineages is not just the consequence of protecting embryo proper, but it may have specific physiological roles in those lineages. And it will be a fascinating area to explore.
Yeah, you could certainly envision that for trophoblasts, maybe less so for amnion or yolk sac, but anyway. So let's turn to the more general question, Ivana. And so in the paper, you mentioned the need to develop strategies for testing cell lines for recurrent abnormalities to make sure that the experimental results are not confounded by their presence, and so that obviously patients don't receive cellular therapeutics that are contaminated with potentially tumorigenic cells. So you've been involved in multiple efforts to help develop standards in this area, starting with the International Stem Cell Initiative, and more recently, the ISSCR Standards Initiative. And we had some very interesting and challenging discussions, I think, during the course of those. Can you discuss some of the strategies, particularly with respect to the latter in the ISSCR Standards document? How do you think we can help the field?
Yeah, I think the ISSCR Standards Initiative represents a really tremendous effort by the ISSCR and the stem cell community to provide recommendations on best practices for working with stem cells in order to improve the rigor and reproducibility of research on stem cells. Of course, one of the key considerations with regards to stem cell quality that are used in research is their genetic integrity. And this is because we now have ample data that, for example, recurrent variants that occur in stem cells do change their behaviors. And that can even include, as we discussed in this study led by Loriana, the ability of cells to differentiate. So as a corollary of this, if we end up using variant cells in our research unknowingly, this can lead to misleading conclusions or misinterpretation of data. And that in itself will then lead to lack of reproducibility between different studies in the field. So I think by suggesting best practices for working and reporting on stem cells, the ISSCR document really stands to minimize these issues in the field. And I also think that by paying more attention to genetic integrity of stem cells, we will gain more very important and useful insight into the kinds of variants that occur in these cells. And that in the long run will also help us to prevent them.
Yes, I think actually people working in clinical translation like Pete have probably done a better job of this than many research labs. But here's the real question we had to cope with was, what practical, simple, straightforward measures can the average stem cell laboratory take to ensure the genetic integrity of their research tools without spending all their budget on sequencing?
Absolutely. I think there are some very simple rules that we can all adopt and implement in our routine laboratory practice. The key is, of course, to work with well-characterized stocks of cells wherever possible, and then monitoring them for the occurrence of genetic variants at regular intervals or as frequently as possible. And, you know, this can entail relatively simple strategies for monitoring variants based on what we know occurs frequently in cultures. We proposed several different assays and different ways of testing cells. But as I say, I think regular monitoring, for example, based on our knowledge that variant cells tend to take over cultures within 5 to 10 passages, we would suggest that cultures or cells are not propagated for very, very long periods of time, if possible. Or if that's not possible, then implementing these checkpoints at regular intervals, for example, every 10 passages or so. Another simple one is that we know that variants tend to take over after some bottlenecks in culture. So, you know, if you're cloning your cells, doing genetic editing, that would be an obvious point to look at your cells. And then, of course, just, you know, get to know your stem cells and see if they change their behaviors. So if you see that your stem cells started to proliferate very fast, all of a sudden they die less, they may change their differentiation propensity. All of these are red flags that may indicate the presence of variants in culture.
Thanks. I've been teaching postdocs for about 25 years to look down the microscope carefully. I haven't been all that successful. I've been successful in some cases, I guess. But anyway, that's great advice. And, you know, the other point I'll make while we're on the topic is that if funding bodies insist on rigor and reproducibility, they should fund mechanisms to ensure that laboratories can do the requisite tests.
Absolutely. I concur. Yes.
Loriana, with all research, and certainly stem cell research is no exception, there's a real need to educate the public. Education enables a greater understanding of the science and its applications, more informed policy, and ultimately more support and potentially funding for advances that can lead to far-reaching benefits to public health. But so you've got a particular interest in this area. Tell us about your interest in public education and a little bit about your award-winning video.
Thank you. You're absolutely right. Science does not exist in a vacuum. And I'm always being personally very keen to see culture as one, with the sciences and the humanities and the arts sitting on the same round table. And I think what is really important is also I've been interested in the sociological aspect of science and how we do science. And I've been very keen to promote the fact that we need to explain how we do science as much as to promote our subject matter. And I think taking that approach allows then the public to understand the subject matter better. So with this kind of core ideas in mind, I had the fortune to make a short film together with the inspirational chair of sociology at Cambridge University, Professor Sarah Franklin, and the brilliant filmmaker Chloe Thomas, which is a director of this film called Dish Life. And this film basically talks about the emotional relationship of the scientist with their stem cells and the painstakingly process of taking care of the cells, feeding them, babysit other cells, and also what introducing some key concept about pluripotent stem cells to a very broad audience. I mean, we have kids simulating stem cells swimming in a pool in the film. So on the back of this effort, we then decided to take a step further and develop the Dish Life into a game that now is free available on phones. And is an app that basically simulates a career in science from an undergrad to a professor. And you basically tackle both scientific challenges, ethical challenges, sociological challenges, and equality and diversity issues, and as well as always feeding the cells as well in the phone. So these really, all of these efforts, I've really got the feedback that I got all the time is that people want to know more about how we do science. And the game is now translated also to other languages in German. And I hope that the listeners on ISSCR that from other countries, if they are interested in contributing to maybe making the translation possible in other languages, just give us a shout.
Yeah, terrific. You should take that up with the society. That's a fascinating thing, exploring the relationship between researchers and their stem cells. I can tell you from personal experience, it's a very complicated one. But, you know, given that kind of experience that you had, I wonder if you had any plans to develop this aspect of your career and turn the story of cell therapy for eye disease into a feature film. I noted that Professor Coffey's lab is just up the 101 freeway up the coast from Hollywood, and there might be opportunities there. Who would you get to play, Pete?
Well, funny you should ask this. Believe it or not, there was a crew that actually came up to Santa Barbara. When I heard you were going to ask me this question, I was thinking, was Martin involved in this in any way? But unfortunately, Jack Black wasn't available to play me. So they had some other character, you know, sort of some handsome sort of Brad Pitt sort. So I said, no, you need a Jack Black. So, no, the one of the guys who was actually a filmmaker with the Douglas Foundation and family did actually visit UCSB to ask these questions. But it wasn't ever pursued, thankfully.
Something you might follow up, Lauriana?
I mean, you just gave me an idea, but I didn't know about this. I mean, this is the first time I hear of it. No, I think more on the lines of during the pandemic, I've been involved in writing my first comedy drama script, which might come as a surprise to Pete. But yeah, I'm keen on exploring and demystifying the way TV and film portray scientists. And I am an absolute fan of Dr. Brown from Back to the Future, don't get me wrong, but I am trying to readdress the balance there. So if anything is in the pipeline, would be something along those lines.
Well, we've had The Office. What about The Lab?
Yeah. It's a great idea. I look forward to seeing it. So, Pete, we're going to finish up on a slightly more serious note. We've been talking about retinal pigment epithelium. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the status of your efforts to develop a treatment for age-related macular degeneration and related disorders. Your London project to cure blindness was one of the pioneering ventures to develop stem cell-derived therapies for retinal disorders. Kind of wondering where we are. I get the impression that we know that treatments are feasible. We're pretty confident they're safe. But how about any signs of benefit at this stage?
Yeah, no, thanks, Martin, for asking. So, as you know, we started treating patients in 2015, so we're now 2023, and we do have patients that are now 8 years with a patch of RPE in the back of their eyes. And Douglas, who became very well known on the BBC, who was one of the first patients, is still reading three lines plus. He's in his mid late 80s now, and he's still got great vision. So, and we can see the cells. We can see the cells on the patch. You know, obviously, it's very easy to image the back of the eye because you know you got a nice window on the front. The great news is there is long-term survival of the cells. There's good functional behavior. He's still reading about 40, 50 words a minute, whereas he couldn't even see the book when he was operated on. The great news is last year we actually opened up the trial now. So we've gone into a second population, which is a much bigger clinical population, but it's still one in which there's an unmet need. So we've started those patients now. So by the end of this year, we would have had enough of those patients to really assess whether that bigger population, which is what we wanted to go into, is actually getting a similar benefit. So it's still on the wet side. And mainly the reason we're going into that clinical group is we know there's still photoreceptors there and there's still a blood supply at the back of the eye. So unlike some of the other programs where they've gone into the dry geographic, you also get damage in the neural retina and damage in the choroid at the back of the vasculature. And we didn't want to go into those because just putting RPE back, the best you would get is a slowing of what is already a blinding disorder. Whereas with the two groups which we're now in, you could at least bring back some good vision. And, you know, hopefully we'll see a similar profile. So, yeah, we're still in there, believe it or not, after, you know, over 17 years. I'm a bit grayer. Well, I'm a lot grayer looking at this image. But we're still, thankfully, getting good responses in these patients. And they are long-term. We're over 3 years. We're over, and like I say, with Douglas now, we're at, you know, nearly 8 years. And he's still got vision, which is extraordinary. But the nice thing is we can still see the cells as well. So they're lasting as well. So it's good. And, you know, if anything, finishing the career of my career and handing over to the early career people here, I think maybe I'll be able to hand over a very good package in terms of clinical care, which if I get there, I'd be over the moon.
Well, that's great to hear. It sounds like you're going to a broader population of patients where you'd have a better chance of seeing some real benefits. Yeah, which is terrific. And this whole experiment with age-related macular degeneration, I think, has been so important for the stem cell therapy field generally. It was a terrific place to start for all sorts of reasons. And it's nice to hear how it's progressing and to hear your perspective. That's all we've got time for today. Thank you for joining us. Thank you especially to our guests for sharing their stories with us today. This has been the Stem Cell Report. Thank you for listening.
The International Society for Stem Cell Research is a global scientific society that promotes excellence in stem cell science and applications to human health. Our vision is a world where stem cell science is encouraged, ethics are prioritized, and discovery improves understanding and advances human health. To join us, visit www.isscr.org/membership.